It is a center for higher learning.
It is a place with centuries of secrets in its shadowed halls.
This is where you have come to learn the mysteries of the cosmos.
Welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast.
They'll teach you.
Hello and welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast, episode 148. This is the podcast dedicated to Call of Cthulhu and other horror and Lovecraft-related role-playing games. I'm Keeper Dan.
I'm Keeper Chad, and this episode we have the third installment in our series of interviews with women in the horror RPG realm with Lisa Paddle of Golden Goblin Press.
I'm Keeper Murph, and to keep up with news items, we're once again recording a separate crier and feedback and a segment to check out.
And I'm Keeper John, and while you're at it, please do take a moment to check out the Women in Tabletop Gaming Month website and read and listen to more interviews with women in the RPG industry, and catch up on Lynn Hardy's blog series where she interviewed women who contributed to Chiasium over the years.
Links in the show notes. And we're going to start things off with our campus crier.
Miskatonic University Campus Crier.
Campus Crier's Miskatonic U student paper. Here's we're going to go through Mythos-related news and feedback for the podcast. This Campus Crier is being recorded on June 7th, 2018.
First up, there's an update on Miskatonic River Press's Punktown Kickstarter. That's right, I said Punktown.
Wow.
And update in the same sentence. It has been nearly 5 years since it was launched back in November 2012. And last year, backers had received a PDF of the first half of the book, and Angus Abramson of Chronicle City was overseeing the completion of the second half. Chiasium has recently received the finished laid-out book for final review, and Angus has advised backers that printing and shipping is slated to start mid-June.
Wow.
Which I cannot tell you how excited I am, because I thought this was dead.
You're backing that?
Yeah.
Who's
I
backer?
Back that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Anyone else?
No, not I.
I had not the funds at the time, so Murph,
time.
Man, you're our emissary. You're our spy.
I'm not a spy.
Uh-huh.
I'm a paid customer at this point.
You're getting a full-on paper copy?
That's a good question. Let me look at my pledge real quick.
Let's click on that Kickstarter link that we're providing in
getting,
the show notes.
I am off the show notes there. I am a gang victim book only. That's the name of the pledge level there, buddy.
The backer level is called Gang Victim?
Yep. Gang Victim Book Only.
Nice.
Gotta love it.
That's bizarre.
Okay.
Do you think it's bizarre? I think it's bizarre as well.
Yeah.
No PDF
version.
Print only, because that was all the fun I had.
Only.
I figured
okay.
I wanted a book more than I wanted anything else.
Cool.
Yeah. We're looking forward to hearing about it, because it looks very cool, but hopefully maybe there'll be other copies available. If the nothing
sure.
else, the PDF
yeah,
might go
happens.
Up on DriveThru.
About 2 weeks ago, Angus actually emailed backers to verify their shipping address, which is good because, you know, many of us have moved since this thing launched. So I updated my shipping address with him, and I didn't actually hear anything back, but, you know, I'm hoping to get a book eventually.
Sounds legit.
Yeah.
By saying that, you totally made it not sound legit.
It's true. But that's me. That's my judge voice. That's just what I do.
You mean your normal voice?
Everything that comes out can't be serious.
Well, you know what is serious?
No.
The Call of Cthulhu books, Down Darker Trails and The Two-Headed Serpent, were named as recipients of the 2018 UK Games Expo Awards. That was very cool. The two were picked from over 200 nominations. The Two-Headed Serpent garnered Best Role-Playing Adventure, and Down Darker Trails landed the Best Role-Playing Expansion Awards. The winners were announced at the UK Games Expo on Sunday, June 3rd. And so we've got a link in the show notes. It's really cool. I know Chiasium was well represented there. You know, Mike Mason was at the convention, and so I saw on social media that he was showing pictures of the awards that they had received and with the books and everything. So that was very cool. So congratulations to them.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Totally. And for the folks that worked on those without books. A doubt.
Congratulations, guys.
You know, I'm running Two-Headed Serpent, cool. And it's a blast.
Maybe I already knew that. I can't remember if I knew that, but that's cool anyway.
You certainly sounded surprised.
And
in a judgy kind of way.
Okay. That's happening to me.
Yeah. Seth Skorkowski has reviewed the Age of Cthulhu scenario that John had written for Transatlantic Terror on Seth's YouTube channel. So it's a nice, thorough look at the adventure with some spoilers, so be aware of that. But check it out if you're thinking about running it. We'll have a link for that.
Yeah, and if you have not checked out Seth's YouTube channel and his reviews, he is just a very talented reviewer. You know, he does game reviews. He primarily does Call of Cthulhu and D&D. And his reviews are very entertaining. He does little skits and characters, and it's just him. But it's amazing that the way that he's been producing these videos and putting it together. So it's just great stuff.
Cool.
And very fair. I think everything that he's ever said, in my reviews, you know, have been, totally legit and fair, assessments and critiques. So.
It does seem like maybe you're saying that because you got a pretty positive review there. I don't want to like throw accusations around.
I did get a pretty positive review. So, and I really want, I actually wrote on his Facebook posting of it. I go, I really want to be his friend, but on the other hand, I also really would like to continue having fair and honest review. So I'm not gonna be his friend. You know, I want him to feel like he can give reviews, you know, without being influenced.
Should we bad talk him a little bit?
Do we need to make fun of him just a slight bit to make your ego feel better
maybe,
about the fact that she gave you a good
review?
Maybe
a little bit, just a touch, maybe.
He's got a funny name.
I don't know about that sepia tone on the Titanic segment he did. That was a little silly.
There you go. I like that. There you go. Mm.
Did he slightly speed up the audio as well?
He might have. So yes, and go check out his stuff. He does good stuff, and he's been doing a great series on Call of Cthulhu as far as the 7th edition rules. He's been breaking that out, so it's pretty cool. You know, we've got his stuff and the stuff that we've done and the stuff that Chiasium is doing. So there's a lot of great stuff out there to get a fair and honest review of the Call of Cthulhu 7th edition rules as well.
And we're a little behind the times on this, but issue number 3 of Dark Times magazine has been released a few weeks back now. But that's the fanzine that picked up the ball from Proto Dimension. And there's lots of great articles in it and adventure seeds and scenarios, and it's free as a PDF. Check it out. And if you have any inkling to write this kind of stuff, by the way, submissions are rolling, and you should contact the excellent humans behind the veil of secret history at darktimesfanzine@gmail.com. That'll be in the show notes.
Zine.
Nope. Denied.
Also available right now, fresh as we see it, at least. You can pre-order the Dark Adventure Radio Theater Massive Narlithip from the HPLHS. And it's it's $70.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is the discounted pre-order. They do say price. It's the largest one ever, but it's still $70.
Yeah.
And it comes with... There's all sorts of stuff. You'll just have to go read it. It's if I had $70 to throw, I would. However, if you've got more like, I don't know, $100 to throw, the Massive Narlithotep Gamer Prop Set is also available now. And it's $95.99.
Uh-huh.
And they're talking about 109 prop documents in that sucker.
Wow.
109 prop documents.
And that'll be on top of your $130 Massive Nyarlathotep.
Right.
New
so
edition.
If you want the full package and you need the other audio to go with it for ambiance, then, you know, you're looking at least $4,000 or $5,000.
Wow. Some quick math. Man, you really calculate. You're like a Mentat from Dune.
That includes the purchase of a walnut coffin to use as a gaming table. So,
oh man,
that option's only included if you're married
and dead.
No, it's assumed you will be dead by the time it arrives.
That's exactly. Right.
Insert body here.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's by my will alone. I set my mind in motion.
You know, I do love the prop gaming thing here because we got that 109 prop documents, but it also has an Edifone wax cylinder case with a custom USB drive containing props that are audio files
by HPLHS
actors and transcripts, so that way you can hand them out as handouts.
Okay, but also experts, what would the audio props be? Are there recordings involved?
No.
Maybe some radio broadcasts about.
Maybe they recorded some of the NPC blurbs from some of the big NPCs, like when you get to London and stuff.
Yeah.
Or any,
I don't know. Yeah.
And then there's also six passports issued by the League of Nations and custom stamps for whenever the players travel to different locations in the game.
So, I mean, that alone, come on. I mean, that's worth it.
I mean, that puts this into the legacy gaming aspect where, you know, the players will have those passports. They get stamped as you play, and then you put it away. That's a keepsake, and it's gone. You know? I love it.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that's... And $100 is actually, I think, a really good deal on that, and they say that, yes, the price will definitely be going up.
Yeah, for sure. If I had $100, honestly,
whenever
right now, I'd buy that.
Past the pre-order. Yeah. And it's expecting to ship out, for, at least for the props, in
August 1st. Yeah, August 1st for the prop shipments.
How do they make them so fast?
They've probably been making them for 6 months.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But yes, I'm looking at those and trying to calculate finances.
Luck, man.
Yeah.
Wow. Pretty awesome. Pretty awesome. And then something I wanted to just kind of put in here and let people be aware. There was recently I think this was the fourth annual 200 word RPG contest. Have you guys heard of this?
Totally.
Oh,
I wish that I could have submitted.
So
I did not.
Yeah, I did a submission last year and I did a submission this year and so did Max. And I gotta say, I've read Max's entry, which is called Jordan, A Lifetime in 1 Hour. Now, granted, I haven't read all of the entries this year. The concept, actually, I'm getting ahead of myself. The concept of this contest, for those who are not in the know, is you write a 200-word role-playing game, and that's it. I mean, if any entry is above 200 words, it is not considered in the running for the contest. And this thing has probably got... I think there's probably over 300 entries this year, and these are all so, so interesting. There's just a wide variety of different little role-playing games that are out here. So Max has his Jordan, A Lifetime in 1 Hour, and it is so cool. You you and the other players will, using a certain mechanic that he explains in his game, will dictate the positive and negative happenings of this person named Jordan from his youth to death. And it's very interesting the way he does that. My entry is not nearly as interesting, but it was the only thing I could come up with. I call it Torture Traps, The Last to Die Wins. And it's a kind of my take on the Saw and Belko experiment franchises, you know. So it's all these different torture traps, and it's player versus player, and you basically want to be the last player alive So I don't know. Anyways, I've provided links in the show notes to the contest as a whole, and then also to Max's entry, specifically Jordan, A Lifetime in 1 Hour, and my entry as well. So those will be in the show notes.
Cool. It was really, very cool. I feel like it was really sweet of you to tailor design an RPG for Murph. That's so nice of you. PvP torture. Yeah, right. Sign this guy up.
Yarr. I love you guys. You know me so well.
Since you mentioned Max, I do want to make sure that we send out a huge thank you to Max, who is listening to this right now as he edits. This is your thank you. You can play it a couple times if you want. You know, you could lengthen it.
Yes.
You have the power, but thanks for graciously.
Thank you, Max. Very much. Thanks,
thank
Max.
You, Max. All right.
This is your thing. And into the feedback, starting off with some emails that we are sent from Forrest Aguirre.
Aguirre.
Really? Aguirre? Mm-hmm. Okay. Really? I don't think I've ever pronounced that. From Forrest Aguirre. Really enjoyed the episode on tomes, but I felt like John's idea of the binding, and I assume cover material, of the book having some mechanical effect didn't get enough thought. I know I host a podcast too, and thinking isn't high on the agenda when you're recording.
No, so
true. Yes. I get it. Anyway, John's question got me thinking about the BBC production of The Stone Tape, written by Nigel Keel, wherein some research scientists discover that a stairway carved of stone in the past recorded impressions of certain events that happened there, particularly tragic events. Which, that was also an episode on the Good Friends of Jackson Elias.
I thought it might be cool to have a copy of, insert your favorite Mythos tome here, the Necronaconic, yeah. The Spocus Theris of Galaki, for example. Bound not just in human skin, but in the human skin of a high-ranking sorcerer of the cult who possessed the book. Now, actually, how can you possess the book if it's bound in your own skin? I don't know, but we'll see. Maybe you just got a big patch of skin on your belly missing, right? Because said sorcerer was so powerful, those trying to cast the spell from his book would lose even more sanity than expected if they were to fail their sanity roll. However, they might be rewarded by lowering the number of magic points required to cast a given spell or getting a temporary boost to POW to throw some extra oomph into that spell.
Continuing along here. Of course, you'll want to make it very tempting and even more punishing for player characters to use, hence the risk of increased insanity. You can just bump it up the die chain, so if reading the tome would normally cost 1d6 sanity, the improved version would cost 1d8. Or bump it up to d12 or a d12, guys. A d10 or a d12, whatever. You get the nefarious idea. Just my 2 cents worth of tuition. And again, that was from Forrest Aguirre.
And he mentioned that he is a podcaster, so I thought I might return the favor and let everyone know that his podcast, if you are so interested, is called Glowburn. It is a podcast focused on the Mutant Crawl Classics role-playing game.
Nice. So,
and it's fun. I like the MCC game. It's a lot of fun to play. So I've provided a link in the show notes to the Glowburn podcast.
And next up, we have feedback from Ian Sanford. Hi, folks. I just wanted to give a big thank you from here in Goatswood. I hit a brick wall writing a scenario based on From Beyond, but through listening to your banter in podcast 143, my muse returned and blessed me with horrors upon horrors for my players just in time for my game at the UK Games Expo this coming week. I mean, that's time travel that happened in the past. I just want to clarify.
And he continues, I've not caught up with the podcast for a while, but I still have fond memories of playing with you at Gen Con a few years back. The memories of Chad's character being hit by roof tiles after pushing his luck too far still make me laugh.
Oh, yes, Ian.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Let me continue his email. Anyway, I am back subscribing and enjoying. By the way, any thoughts on game ideas based around From Beyond and other technology-based Cthulhu adventures would be very welcome. Though I guess that would probably that you probably won't come up with any WW2 German POWs trapped in a Goatswood prison camp like me. But cheers, Ian Sanford, Severn Valley, England. Ian, yes, that was I loved that game. Oh my God, I still think of it fondly. And after Chad was hit by those tiles, I went into my nearly can't breathe laughing fit. So,
yeah, we thought you were about to die of a heart attack. Actually,
I did. I fell onto the floor, laughing and gasping for air.
It was epic.
It was a good night. It was a fun night.
There's a live play. We recorded that as well, so that's been immortalized
somewhere. I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
But as far as the idea of technology-based Cthulhu stuff, that needs to be jotted down as a show topic, because that sounds like...
That's a show topic.
Definitely a show topic. Yeah. Thank you, Ian.
That's something we can riff on.
Totally.
And starting off, first up, we've got a voicemail from Ritterton.
Welcome back, Ritterton.
Good morning. This is Ritterton calling in from the Columbia River. Great podcast and interview with Stuart. That was just fascinating to listen to. I would argue some of the Pacific Northwest probably has got some areas that need some mythos treatment as well, period. And then there was the short segment on the sleeping old one. So it just entered my mind as you guys were talking. What about a priest and priestess embedded in a furry convention trying to take it over? And others having to sort out who's what, where, and what role they're playing, or are they just playing a role in the convention? So, a great podcast, always fun to listen to while I'm on these long drives. Thanks, and go Pods!
That's awesome.
And now we've got a voicemail from our dear Mr. Tyler about last episode's The Great Fire of Mereki.
Hello, Keepers. This is Sam Tyler, Mr. Tyler, if you're in detention. I had a thought while listening to the excellent segment by Jonathan about the cursed kimono that sparked a devastating fire after a priest burned it. You know, fire is one of the primary tools in the investigator toolbox when battling the mythos. If it's not plan A, it's probably plan B. I love the idea of twisting the old standby strategies players have used for years to contribute to the horror or adding a level of danger. You know, they defeat the monster with fire, but its flesh acts like thermite, showering white-hot sparks that instantly ignite everything they touch. Do the investigators stay and fight the fire or run for it, probably before the cops show up? I'd love to hear your thoughts on the way a clever keeper could twist the common strategies used against the unknown, how you can subvert or add horror to their triumph. What are some things you guys could think of? And thanks for all the lovely compliments about my detentions. Go Pods.
Nice.
That was cool.
Yeah.
Like that.
The segments are talking
to each
other.
It's almost like we're meta. Do we need to be here at this point?
I'm out.
That was total.
Yeah, I love the idea of taking the things that are, you know, commonly used and adding an extra level of potential risk if they do it, that they may or may not. I love the idea that, yeah, a creature's body acts like thermite if it catches fire.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good one. I mean, some of those other tropes would be like shotgun shells, mess with those in some way, make them early discharge and therefore backfire, or I don't know.
Sort of ability to project a projectile that hits them directly back at the source.
Right. You know? Or, yeah, just turning gun barrel metal into, you know, soft. I mean, I think, actually, I don't know gun physics enough to know, but, like, if the metal itself becomes more malleable, I assume that it would be an automatic backfire.
Your logic is sound. So the M60 machine gun typically is manned by a two-man crew with two barrels, or even more than two barrels sometimes, and basically asbestos gloves, so that if you're in a combat situation and you've been firing that thing repeatedly on full auto, that barrel will be literally glowing red hot, and it's designed for the other guy wearing the gloves to reach up, twist, remove that barrel, set it off to the side, and put the new one on that's cool and ready to fire, and then you just keep going in a combat situation. So it is possible if the weapon is engineered to fire enough rounds fast enough, it can overheat. But that usually is only in a machine gun kind of capacity.
Mm-hmm. So if it was done externally, it wouldn't be designed with hot swap parts.
Yes, right. It's right as opposed to heating up from the inside.
Oh, yeah. So, and especially if it was a weapon that wasn't designed to have removable and swappable parts, enough external heat would certainly warp and ruin the ability mm-hmm. for a weapon to fire.
Yeah.
I've always liked the idea of the low level spells like attract fish, right? So this would be one of those spells that would be totally, well, mostly useless in most contexts, but heat metal, like not melt metal or not something powerful like that, but just a spell that heats metal. But, you know, some cultist who knows that mm-hmm. that's how you get rid of sure. guns.
Yeah. You cast that on a revolver in somebody's holster and all those rounds start going off.
Right, right. And you know, with the new way that spells are designed with the deeper version of a spell, you could have the heat metal normally would be enough heat to ignite rounds, you know, that are sitting in a holster or sitting in a chamber or in a clip or something. But then if you go to the deeper version, it would actually maybe in a focused area slag the metal.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yep. How about flashlights, being able to amplify the light of a flashlight so that
or
it blinds people. Or burns, sure. Yep. White hot.
That's pretty cool.
Mm. Yes.
Study the work of your school librarian, and perhaps you can secure permission to assist.
And went on into the card catalog. The affable and scholarly Canna Geek wrote in, and he shared with us a link to a recording of The Raven, read by none other than Christopher Lee.
Oh, wow.
That's awesome.
Yeah. He says, recordings of Poe by Christopher Lee seem like the sort of thing the fans of your podcast might enjoy, and I would have to agree.
Totally.
Yep.
Now we have a contributor segment from Mr. Tyler, the third in his series on Seth Agua.
Yeah, these are so good.
Quiet down, quiet down. Looks like you're here once again in detention with Mr. Tyler. If I'd known that you were joining the Genealogical Society just so you could tell poor Arthur Jerram that his great-great-great-great-grandmother was a gorilla, the faculty would never have let you print out the quarterly newsletter. I can't imagine his reaction to this. Since I have to stay behind with you guys to administer your punishment, we're going to talk about whatever I want to talk about. We've been looking at Seth Agua and some of the interesting aspects of this great old one. However, you're more likely to encounter a great old one's worshippers than a great old one. So today we're going to look at two examples of Seth Agua cults. Folklore from East Anglia and Lincolnshire tells us of witches known as toad men who have made a deal with the devil to gain complete control over horses. Every initiate kills a toad or frog and leaves its body outside to decay or leaves it on an anthill to be picked clean. Then they throw the remaining bones into a running stream or river during certain specific phases of the moon. All the bones float downstream except for one, which unnaturally floats against the current, identifying this particular bone as the Toad Man's magic bone, or wishbone. Armed with dark magic and his wishbone, a Toad Man can force a horse to follow his will. The wishbone can also grant them luck with the opposite sex, or open locked doors, or shrink down so they can fit between the slats in a wooden wall, or just to be incredibly lucky at darts. This is England, after all. Stories of Toadmen and their incredible powers carry into the late 1930s, which nicely covers the classic period of Call of Cthulhu gaming. Now you're probably thinking to yourself, this sounds like sympathetic magic, but what's the connection between horses and toads? Well, I'm glad you asked such an intelligent question. From the center to the back of a horse's foot, behind the hoof, is a V-shaped pad, which acts as a shock absorber and helps pump blood through the horse's leg. This pad is called a frog. Although Toadmen originate with English folklore, all this talk of horses makes me think of the American Southwest. Maybe a few Toadmen are working on a horse ranch. The ranch is successful and breeds immaculately trained horses. However, the occasional pony is born with a strangely obese body and a very broad head and a wide mouth. The Toadmen believe these are the specially chosen. These ponies are sent to a special herd that is secluded out in the meadow, far from visiting eyes. Sometimes, during certain phases of the moon, strange ecstatic neighs and brays can be heard, and as long as the ranch stays prosperous, the ranch hands aren't looking into it. Clark Ashton Smith introduced Sathagua in his Hyperborean cycle of stories, which take place in the titular Iron Age setting. Smith didn't invent Hyperborea. It goes back all the way to the ancient Greeks, who believed it to be an idyllic land far to the north of Thrace. Since then, so many legends, beliefs, and just plain wackadoo has been bolted onto Hyperborea. From Atlantis, to root races, to lost advanced technology, to giants, to Tibetan mysticism, the Hollow Earth. It goes on and on and on. And it's all wrapped up and ready to lead to Sathagua. From Hyperborea, it's only a hop, skip, and a jump to the Hyborian Age of the Conan the Barbarian stories by Robert E. Howard. In one of his stories, Howard has Conan face down a shadowy toad demon named Thog. Personally, I think it'd be really fun to combine the works of Lovecraft, Smith, and Howard under one cult. Just imagine a Wisdom of the Ancients cult. Its followers wear white robes to signify they are untouched by the modern world, and they espouse the wonders and the amazing majesty of ancient Hyperborea, slideshow presentations, that sort of thing. They claim their beliefs are descended from the root of all major religions, they're older than Zoroastrianism and Mithraism. All the members of the Wisdom of the Ancients cult venerate an unseen master named Thog, personified by a strangely repellent toad-like idol. Maybe they're funding research and archaeology into strange ruins across the Northern Hemisphere, Greenland, Russia, Canada, all over the place. Or maybe they've opened a rehab clinic, which encourages its patrons to go their own pace in their recovery and maybe a little bit of self-medication to ease their transition. Maybe graduate from cocaine down to toad licking. I hope that's gotten your thoughts stirring about how to use Sathagua in your role-playing games. There's a lot more to him than his reputation as a lazy, sleepy, fuzzy great old one would suggest. That's it for your detention. Stay out of trouble.
Eat that. Those are always so good.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. I mean, those the three segments together about Sathagua was such a deep dive. So many hooks.
That kind of merges together into sort of a complete redefining of the character for use.
Yeah, totally. In about a thousand ways, he sort of drops hooks like a basket of keys on the table.
Yeah, it's wow. Thank you, Mr. Tyler. That was very, very cool.
Also, miniature horse toads. Did I hear that right? That I can't stop thinking about miniature horse toads.
I liked it.
Yeah,
it was awesome as usual.
And if anyone else has an interest in producing a segment for the podcast, please reach out and contact at mup.feedback@gmail.com. And now we get into our main topic, is the interview with Lisa Paddle.
Awesome.
Settle down now, class. It's time for your next lesson.
Hello, this is Keeper Chad, and I'm talking to Lisa Paddle, the staff editor for Golden Goblin Press, among other hats that she wears. And we're going to talk a little bit about editing and work with Golden Goblin and other projects that she may have going on. So happy to have you on the show finally, Lisa.
Thanks. Now that we've beaten the technical difficulties into the ground.
Yes, we've just to let listeners know, we've spent, a not so bad 15, 20 minutes trying to figure out how to get recordings going, but we're good now. So I want to talk about your gaming history a little bit, how you got into gaming, and then how you sort of transitioned into working within in the industry, including your work for Golden Goblin. So what brought you to the gaming table initially?
My dad bought a copy of, I think, White Box D&D when I was about 10. He taught at Truman High School, and one of his colleagues had a son a year older than me. And so they introduced us because I'm into gaming, he's into gaming, and that's how I started getting into gaming.
Okay, so lifelong gaming, basically, all the way back.
Yeah.
So going back to your first days as a creator now, I think that, if I'm not mistaken, is the Postmodern Magic book for Unknown Armies your first foray into creating for the industry, or was there before that? Or
unless you count reviews, probably. Unless you count Alarms and Excursions, anyway.
Oh, okay. What is that? I don't know.
Are you familiar with APAs and fanzines and all of that?
Sure, yeah.
So way back years ago, there was a fanzine, an APAzine, I think about languages, I'm not quite sure. But a lot of the people in it started talking about their gaming campaigns, and folks said, that's not actually what this particular app is for. So Lee Gold started Alarms and Excursions, and she's still running it. We're still sending in our contributions every month.
Oh, cool.
And she's got gaming chops at least a decade longer than I do.
Nice.
Right. She did GURPS Japan, Land of the Rising Sun, Lands of Adventures, and yep, Ice Vikings. And Alarms and Excursions is, at this point, over 40 years old, I think.
Wow. And is that then someone who encouraged you to do some creative work for the industry?
It was more that she provided a forum for all of us. I mean, before you had online forums, what you had were APAs.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then how did you then get to the point where you were, I'm looking at the Postmodern Magic book, your credit in that.
Oh, Greg Stolze was also in Alarms and Excursions.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he was in it. Edmund Shaw was in it, and he started the Familiar magazine, where I was doing reviews for him and then editing the magazine. Greg, I gather, had made a comment sometime in the 90s about how if Lisa Paddle would condescend to write for Mere Filthy Lucre, and I'm like, wait, he said what? I will condescend. Where's the filthy lucre?
I'm condescending. Here's me condescending.
and turned out he and John Tynes were looking for a little bit of writing for that, which I actually did with Joshua Cronengold. So we were together then and had been for some time, and so we were bouncing ideas back and forth. And I know we had more ideas than actually made it in. I did a couple of reviews for The Unspeakable Oath. I remember there was one that I referred to as the Soundbites book because it had clearly been written for someone who wanted to read in soundbites, and the research was perhaps not all that.
Oh, no.
If I can catch somebody's research errors with weapons, there's a problem. And with Lovecraftian gaming, you're heading into historical gaming, which means that you probably care at least a little bit about getting it right. If you're publishing it, your readers will definitely care whether you've gotten it right or not.
You speak from experience.
On both sides.
Yeah.
I will bitch and moan very loudly if you get something I know wrong.
Right. That's a great part of what you bring to Golden Goblin, I understand. Checking what's right and also poking holes in plots, I understand, is kind of a superpower of yours.
Trail of Cthulhu actually taught me that. When Trail of Cthulhu came out, everyone was going, I don't understand the initiative system. I'm sorry, not initiative system, the investigative system.
Yeah, yeah.
Did exactly what it said on the tin. This is easy. If that were all the Trail of Cthulhu brought to the table, it could be replaced by a post-it note that said, do not let the plot stall because your players screw up their die rolling.
Right.
The thing is, what it actually brings to the table is a way of thinking about information. What information do the PCs need to get to the next scene so that they don't come crashing into, well, I guess we break out the board games because we can't solve the plot tonight. Okay, information is information. It's your clue is not a diary. Your clue is the information in the diary. If the PCs don't find that diary, okay. Can they get it from the person who wrote the diary babbling? Can they find out from a cop who confiscated the diary? Does somebody remember this person in high school? Is it a map to somewhere, in which case can they find out about that some other way? What is the information the PCs must get? And when I edit a scenario, I put on my idiot cap.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be not the stupidest GM ever, but a GM who's new to this, who's getting the scenario and who's assuming it's got everything he or she needs and hasn't yet gotten practiced in filling in the gaps that even the best campaigns and scenarios will leave. And so I'll put things in the margins like, okay, and when they blow their roll here, because we're talking, they have to make a Cthulhu Mythos roll if they even have that. What do? Break out the board games? Okay, and if everyone blows their spot hidden here? I mean, were you there when I ran Needles?
No, I wasn't. No, I've run it, but I wasn't present.
So the very first version of that required two library use rolls for a particularly obscure clue. I was running this, and I was running this for Oscar Rios and group of people who played fairly often, and they immediately went into circle the wagon, do the research, we know the drill, and no one could make a library use roll to save their lives.
Right.
Not even one, let alone two. And what do you do when that happens? Because it is perfectly reasonable to call for one library use roll, but as we've seen, even when we had, I think one player's character had it at like 70-some-odd%, and she just couldn't roll under it.
Yep, it happens. I've been there, for sure.
And then there will be times where I'll say, okay, I know you cannot plan for all contingencies, but there are certain things that you know PCs will do because you've played the game too. So it's, okay, they won't let anyone speak to them. Okay, these are PCs. What do you do when they start throwing money at them or pulling rank on them or using credit rating or social status?
Right.
And what does it break if the PCs speak to them? Why are we trying to stop this? Is it because it's a red herring and there's no further information to be gained? Because that you can solve one way. Or is it because if they talk to this person, the whole plot falls apart? That maybe you don't want the whole plot to fall apart if that happens.
Right.
Find
a new way. Find other rivulets around.
Well, there's a lot of, and I'm as guilty of this as anyone, lazy writing and lazy GMing where you're basing something on they won't spot a lie, or they won't figure out someone's possessed, or they won't find the MacGuffin. And then you find yourself trying to jump through hoops to make sure that whatever they try, they don't do whatever it is that'll break your plot. Okay, can you write your plot so that it's not that fragile? And as I said, I'm as guilty of this as anyone.
Sure. I think, there's a way of approaching a scenario where you might just be playing on a whim. Maybe some other game fell apart. You don't have much time to prep. So calling someone lazy is not necessarily all that accurate. It may be just that there's not, they are trusting the scenario to help them through it without.
Oh, if you're trusting the scenario, you're not the one being lazy. The author's the one being lazy.
Right.
No, really. Yeah. When I started reading the early White Wolf stuff, it's gotten better over time, but the early White Wolf stuff was, and when your players try to do this, just don't let them.
Right.
What? Seriously? I've paid 5 points for my haven, and you've said this person just waltzed in there while I was asleep and staked me, so that I have to listen to his threats. Why am I paying 5 points for my haven, then?
Strips you of agency.
Yeah, yeah. And the agency question is a really delicate one. Now, there are other solutions as well. You get a game like Lovecraft-esque. It's doing something very different from what Call of Cthulhu's doing, from what Trail of Cthulhu's doing. Call of Cthulhu has a different way of looking at things than Unknown Armies does, than Delta Green does. And in Alarms and Excursions, we were discussing this. I said, the thing is, Unknown Armies is very much about people trying to fix the world. And however much or little chance they have, it's a much more optimistic game, even at its bleakest, than Delta Green, which is very clear about what kind of game it is as well. And it is a game about gradually realizing we're fucked.
And there's a certain loss of humanity, too, in Unknown Armies, no? Is that, am I getting the mechanics right? Where you're sort of eroding your, you're hardening against things, but you're also eroding your grip on reality a little bit.
To a degree. I can't speak for third edition because I have not finished reading third edition, but yeah. The idea is, as you get more hardened notches, you get less able to flip-flop the roles because you're becoming not less human in the sense that there are all too many humans who do this, but less flexible, less healthy.
Right.
Did you ever read the game Cult, K-U-L-T?
No, I've heard an awful lot about it, and I've never read it.
There were two things I loved about it. One was that it, at a time when White Wolf was just beginning and talking about the darkness, it was going there. It was showing it. And the other thing was, so you have a mental balance. It can be positive. It can be negative. If you're way negative, you're not normal. You're not sane. If it's way positive, you're not normal. Mm. You're not sane.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you are going the saint route or the sinner route. By the norms of what the worldview was, which is all centered around, there is an illusion that you're buying into it. It's the red pill in the Matrix.
Right.
And one of the ways of breaking through the illusion is to go very far in one direction or another. And then, of course, that gets into the whole discussion of what is normal, what is sane, particularly in 2018, where a lot of people are saying, hey, people are far more neurodiverse than we give them credit for, than we're willing to look at. Many of them play role-playing games. Maybe we shouldn't be throwing around terms like insane and sanity so easily.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question in horror RPGs, because it's, I mean, starting with Call of Cthulhu, it's been such a pillar, right, of what makes a game, not all of them, you know, GURPS doesn't necessarily have a insanity mechanic or a sanity mechanic, but yeah, it is an interesting emerging question, I think, about what to do.
Becky Slit, who's designing an amazing powered by the Apocalypse game, I'm blanking on what she calls the game, but she refuses to use the term sanity. I don't remember if she's using insight, which I know is what Graham does in Cthulhu Dark, because you're learning more and more. You're having more and more insight into the universe, but it's something similar. You're learning more about the truth behind the universe, and that's what's going up, and that's what's changing you.
Right. I noticed that he changed. It used to be an insanity die in Cthulhu Dark. Yeah.
Yes. Insight makes more sense.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But then again, Cthulhu Dark is very carefully focused, and there's a lot of discussion. You know how you can play the rich dilettante in Call of Cthulhu and Trail of Cthulhu?
Right.
That's not what you're supposed to be doing in Cthulhu Dark. You're playing people without power. It is this is made very explicit. Whereas Call of Cthulhu, yeah, you can be a dilettante. When you're fighting something with tentacles, who cares?
Right, right. So it questions privilege, because the privilege doesn't help you in the end, but it is almost mechanized that, you know, it's a character class. It's like privilege might as well be the name of the character class, right? New England Brahmin.
Yeah. And if you're playing Call of Cthulhu, you're bringing different assumptions to the game.
Right.
Because it's a different game. And that's fine. What you want to be aware of is what game you're playing, what assumptions are you bringing, and where do you go from there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what do you, when you are tackling a scenario and picking it apart and digging in, what for you is this core joy? What do you enjoy most about that process?
As an editor, as a player, or as a GM?
As an editor, let's talk first about that.
If I start picking it apart, I go, oh my God, I have to run this. Then we're talking.
Great. Right. And you must feel that first as, so you approach it in a way as a reader, as a consumer, I guess, to some degree.
Yeah. One of the things Oscar told me back when Miskatonic River Press was still doing its thing was that Tom had said to him that there are plenty of people who are fine editors. There are plenty of people who are better editors than I am. But one of the things that I'm really good at bringing to the table is, okay, this is a text that you're going to play, that you're going to run as a GM. Yes, I'm going to get down on you if you have a run-on sentence or a fragment, and I will beat my head against the desk and I will swear at the text because, damn it, semicolons are not that hard to use. But I will also say, Ahan, when the players do this, what are you going to do?
Right.
Ahan, what are you going to do when the players get suspicious of her and stab her because they don't know why this weird woman is poking into their business? Or what are you going to do when you have a total party kill there? Although usually that's Oscar's department. One of the things he can do better than I can, which is one of the reasons we work well together, is look at the stats. I can look at it and say, Oscar, can you take a look at this monster? Is it just me or is this like a little too powerful for your average group? He'll look at it and say, TPK in two rounds tops. We got to do something about this.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. That is a very particular skill to be able to turn stats into narrative, you know?
Yeah. It's one of the things in any game I run that I worry about, calibrating the opposition.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's rivals or tentacled monstrosities, I want to know how hard I'm hitting. And I don't always. Now, recently, of course, things have gotten way more interesting because of 7th edition.
It's, do tell. So
I like 7th edition. The more I am reading it, the more I like it. It does a lot of things better. It cleans up a lot of things. Okay, there are a couple of things I probably think 6th edition or 5th edition did better. I imprinted on 4th edition because that was the first one I bought.
Mm.
Like, for example, if we're fighting, okay, you're attacking me. I have a choice. I can stand there and do nothing, which I probably won't do because it's dumb. I can just defend myself, or I can try and attack you back. If I attack you back and I fail or I tie, you hit me. If I defend and I fail, you hit me. But if I defend and we tie, you don't hit me. And if we're both attacking at the same time, combat's going to go a lot faster. And I like that. I like also that we're taking degrees of success into account the way HeroQuest was doing. So when I heard they'd gotten rid of the resistance table, and everyone was saying, well, good, it was so complicated. My first reaction was, okay, I don't know if it's a good idea or a bad idea, but what is so complicated about the resistance table? I can do this in my head. I mean, I do not math particularly well, but this is a very easy formula. But what they're actually doing here is saying, okay, let's look at degrees of success here. Is it a regular success? Is it, I think, hard, which is half? Is it exceptional, which is a fifth? Is it a critical? And this becomes important because, so, Tatters of the King. Near the end, you're going to be facing an avatar of Haster. I think this is not giving away a hell of a lot.
Sure. It's Tatters of the King. Okay. Yeah.
Now, Haster has a power of 35. Okay, I can do math. What this means is, anyone human who is in a power versus power contest against Haster loses. Because Haster's power is more than 10, more than what your maximum human power is going to be for anyone who isn't a powerful sorcerer and probably has zero sanity And if you're starting with beginning PCs, no one is going to have a power greater than 18.
Right.
Which means that if Haster does his, I'm going to mesmerize you and draw you into this dance until you die, you don't have a chance. And this is something any GM must take into account. One of the things Tatters of the King does very well, by the way, is it doesn't use sorcerers a lot, but everywhere it uses a spellcaster, it says, these are the tactics they're going to use. These are the spells they're going to cast. This is how many magic points it will take them down to.
Yeah.
And I really wish more adventures did that because...
Here, here. Totally agree. I can't look at a spell list and... I mean, I would prefer to invent it myself and pick my own spells than to look at a monster in a book and just look at the spell list and think, so how would this go? I would love guidance on... You know, especially not every wizard slash, you know, spell user is going to use the same tactic, right? It depends on their personality. I'm so on board with it. You just said.
Also, I am crap at strategy and tactics for monsters. You give me a powerful monster and pit me up against a group of PCs played by my local players. Yeah, that monster's going to bite it. I just can't plot that well. If you tell me these are the tactics you need to use, this is what you need to bear in mind. Then I've got a fighting chance of at least making them sweat for it.
Right. Yeah. And I also love all, you know, when there's a little scene setting that's specific to that moment, that's not just monster specific, but sort of the context. So this, you know, this wizard is going to defend this corner of the room where there's a box with a special thing in it. That's the job. So you sort of know how the story will unfold. You have some indicators that are not just combat. So yeah, totally agree.
Yeah. I mean, the flip end of this, of course, is monsters that are more powerful than you think they are. For example, Knight's Black Agents. Renfields almost always have Unfeeling as one of their freebie powers. It's a logical thing to give to Renfields. Everybody does it. Unfeeling means that they can keep fighting when they hit -0, -5, -10.
Hmm.
It basically gives them an extra 12 hit points de facto.
Right.
Which means that there was one fight that the PCs had when I was running Carmilla Sanction with like 3 Renfields. And it went very well. The PCs won, but it took a long time because they had to bring them down to -12. At which point it's like, okay, we're at the end of the session based on the clock and you're doing this thing which would normally short circuit this, but this fight has gone on so long. Yes, you can absolutely get the information that way.
Right, right.
But anyway, so yeah. If you're using 7th edition, you have a better chance of at least for a round or two resisting Haster because it's no longer a matter of you must get an 01 as soon as his power is 10 more than your power. Is your degree of success better than what the GM's rolling? It's not a great chance, but it's an existent chance.
Oh, I see. Right, right. It's not just a linear part of the percentile chain. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a game changer, and it's a really useful game changer. They also have a lot of the advice that people have figured out over the years, you know, the idea of failing forward. Okay, you get the clue, because if you don't get the clue, we go around in circles. But, okay, what piece of bad luck do you have? Are you maybe obvious about getting it? Have you tipped off the opposition? Did a neighbor see you break into into their house? Because PCs have this habit of breaking into people's houses.
Yes. Yeah, agreed.
And one of the things that Trail of Cthulhu does is it says, okay, we're not trying for everyday realism. We're trying for genre realism. We're trying for what does it look like in the movies that you've been watching. And Call of Cthulhu has a rule set that's kind of in an interesting position. On the one hand, it's trying to take advantage of what, 40, 50 years worth of gaming now?
Right.
But it also has to stay what it is because that is what a lot of the people who started playing it, continued to play it, are still playing it, are looking for.
Yeah.
It has to play to its strengths.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting design problem.
It's yeah.
Legacy and bringing some things forward, but not too many. Yeah. It's a very interesting.
It's gotten to the point where I am finding myself going, huh, I'm actually getting impatient with at least pre-7th because I've not played 7th as a GM. And as a player, it doesn't matter because I don't have to know the system. I just need to know what am I rolling and when.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was running at the same time, Masks of Nyarlathotep for one group and Eternalize for another, I found myself getting more and more impatient with, I think it was 5.5 I had, 5th edition, 6th edition, Call of Cthulhu, because the percentile dice are so random, which would never have happened if I wasn't also running a trail campaign. And they're two very different systems doing two very different things.
Yeah.
And it's just very interesting noticing how playing the one makes you say, but it's harder to go back to the other. Now, the bonus and penalty dice actually help a lot in 7th edition because you can do things that will give you a bonus die. You can push a roll, which helps. I'm still on the fence about spending luck points, but that's a personal matter. It's one of those I grew up with luck points being used this way, get off my lawn sort of things.
Sure. There is something to be said for playing, tapping into a certain nostalgia, a certain, like you said, imprint, right? That is part of why we play role-playing games, is that it touches some part of our past as well. So that's not to be dismissed. As people like, to some degree, to play how they played. But there are, I'm totally on board as well. There are many things that about 7th that I really like. There are a handful of things that, like luck spending, that I'm not so interested in. But I appreciate some of the improvements. So how did you get involved in Golden Goblin? And how did you meet Oscar? I don't know that story, actually.
So what happened was I had heard that there was this new monograph from Chaosium, the Ripples from Carcosa. And I had to have this because I'm a Haster girl. And so I went to Dreamation or DexCon. I don't remember if it was in January or July, so I don't remember which one it was. And there was like one copy of this left for sale, and I grabbed it. And he happened to be standing right there and said, "Oh, great, I'm the author." I said, "Could you autograph this for me, please?" And he was running In a Family Way, which I got into at, it was like the midnight to 4 a.m. slot. And it is one of those scenarios that I do not know if he will ever publish, though I hope he does. What I would like to see at some point is a collection of all the scenarios that are solidly good, but that people kind of hesitate to suggest publishing because some of the content is a little, I won't say triggery because a lot of published scenarios are, but edging up on the type of controversy they're not sure they want to let themselves in.
Yeah, yeah. I totally agree, and I believe that you and I are applying pressure on the two fronts then, because I know of a few scenarios. There's one set in Japan that he just ran.
Setting Sunrise in Time?
Yeah, yeah.
I love that. I love that scenario.
Yeah, and you know, I've talked to a lot of authors who have these in their back pocket, but they'd say, "Yeah, only for my home game, or only one shots."
He's running at conventions. Yeah. They've run at conventions. Yeah. So anyway, so that's how I met Oscar, and I would game with him at Dreamation and DexCon. I met Tom, and then they were starting with Keith Herber, Miskatonic River Press, and I was working for Hagstrom Maps until 2008 when a bunch of us got laid off. And so one of the things I did was say, "Hey, given I've got time on my hands, would you like an editor? What would you pay an editor?" And Doc wrote back to me, "You have to understand, I don't get a paycheck. There's no actual money in this." And like, okay, that's a reasonable answer. And then a couple of the books hit the shelf at The Strategist. I forget which collection of scenarios it was, but it was that one and Dead But Dreaming, I think, was reprinted. And so I bought them both and wrote an email to him saying, "So I saw these books at The Strategist. I bought them. They look great. And, you know, I've still got time on my hands. You know, I understand there's no money in it, but I really want to do this editing. sent the email off, went to Chaosium's homepage and found out I'd sent the email to a dead man because he died like that night or the day before.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And Oscar and Tom were pulling things together as best they could. And so we were talking. And finally, Tom said to me, okay, I don't remember if it was Tom or Oscar, but basically the deal was, this is how we're going to do it. We're going to have a contract. It's going to be an actual contract. And this is what we're going to pay you. And we understand it's not that much. And it wasn't, but it was three figures. And I'm looking at those three figures going, I understand this is more of an honorarium than a salary or even a contract thing, but you can afford to pay me in three figures? I'm impressed. Because I know how much money they were not making.
Right.
So, yeah. And, okay, fine. That means I will bump this to the top of my queue of stuff to do. And that one also had another thing I had to check, was the conversion to Trail of Cthulhu. And that was absolutely fascinating because it gave me my first taste of how Trail differed from Call. So, like, in Call of Cthulhu, if I'm a bookseller and I've got a book at a high price, there's no reason for you not to try to bargain with me. There's no reason for you not to roll the dice, right?
Sure, right.
If it's Trail of Cthulhu, you have to spend a point to bargain. I mean, you'll get it for this amount of money. You can make a credit rating spend. You want to bargain me down? Fine. Pay a point of bargain. Do you feel like you can afford to spend that point of bargain here? Are you going to need it elsewhere? And suddenly it's a different way of playing the game. Because he could do the same math I was doing, going, yep, they're spending, The thing is, as a GM, I'm also trying to run the fight, and running fights is not the part of GMing I do best.
Right. Yeah, I feel the same. Yep, yep. Takes a lot of concentration to keep all those things tracked. And anytime you add another bean that needs to be counted, I start to get a little anxious. So
yeah, it's the sort of thing that makes people go, I'll run Cthulhu Dark next time.
Yeah.
But that is not an easy system to run. I mean, people have asked, wait a minute, this is a 2-page game that he's expanded to how many pages? And I'm like, well, ignoring the fact that a whole lot of this is scenarios and different time eras, it's because it's so simple that he has to spend so much time explaining it. It's deceptively simple.
Yeah. Yeah, it takes a certain virtuosity, especially a range of these success levels from 1 to 6. That is something that, you know, telling the difference between a 2 and a 3. And we've had him on the show, and I've mentioned that, yeah, like the difference between a 3 and a 4, that's kind of tough. And his response is, stop, just don't worry about that. You know, stop your stress. There's no reason to get, but I still think it requires.
He's not wrong. It's just, when you get it, what you get is relax, just roll with it. And there have been times I've done that. There was one time I was playtesting Fate of Cthulhu. And it was about an hour before everyone was due to come over. And I looked and said, okay, I've come up with the name of the resort that the action's going to take place in. And I've come up with a grand total of 2 aspects. And I'm done. There is nothing more I can do to prepare for this. I know this group. I'm going to have to hold on for the wild ride they're going to take me on. And you're going to hit a point after a while where you know your group, you know your material, you're done. Everything's going to go off script, but you can only prep so much for that.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about working with Golden Goblin. So you started with Miskatonic River Press, and then as that sort of sunsetted and became, and the sort of spiritual successor, I think, to some degree, became Golden Goblin Press. You followed, but you now have been working as an editor with Oscar for quite a while on a lot of different projects.
Yeah, let's see, 1, 2, 3. I think this is the 5th. Let's see. Islands of Ignorance, Crescent City, De Horror, Caribbean, and Invictus. And there was one fiction collection that he had me looking over. And at one point he's saying, no. All you have to do is just look at this, this, and this. I'm like, Oscar, if you're having me do this at all, trust me, I'm not going to be bringing things to your attention that are minor, and I can't not do this. And it worked out well enough for whatever it was I was looking at. You know, I don't remember if that was Golden Goblin or Miskatonic River Press. Wow.
Now, I know that you work very well together, and that relationship is a complimentary one for sure. And you both talked about this, different skills, different perspectives that you bring to the editing table.
Yeah. I mean, recently we had an argument that got resolved by making the thing we were arguing over into a dog. That was amusing.
What? Wait a minute.
Okay, so there was an NPC. We have three NPCs that are going to show up in Cthulhu Invictus. And originally, one of them had some kind of artifact that would detect deep ones. And I'm like, excuse me, we are not in the Buffyverse. This is not a cross-finding vampires. Well, what if I only make it work once a week? No, that doesn't solve it. Also, what happens if it falls into the hands of PCs? Let me tell you stories about what the PCs will do if that is the case, because I've had to deal with this on a different topic. What if I make it a dog that can just smell deep one blood? Ah, that works. Okay, great. I get to put another dog in. You knock yourself out. Actually, I'm going to make it a whole bunch of dogs because the deep ones probably kill them. Yeah, that works.
Nice.
Yeah. It is the stupidest thing to get into an argument about, except that it isn't. It matters.
Would that many more problems could be turned into dogs, you know? That's a pretty good strategy.
At the end of the day, you're going to have a deadline. And you have to balance, and I hate it, but you have to balance the perfectionism and getting it out at all. I mean, we don't want to have a product that's waiting and waiting and waiting because we're trying to make it more perfect. Having a product waiting because this product bumped this product, which means we have to do this to this because we've got a license for this and have to do this thing, that's one thing, and that's something that's not always within our control. Having to wait because there's a third party involved, not always in our control. But deciding when we're saying, okay, we're not making any more calls of it, that is within our control. And whatever we choose, there's always going to be something we missed.
Yeah.
Hopefully it'll be a small something.
Right. Here's to having it be small somethings.
Yeah.
So I want to make sure we're talking, this is going to air in June. We'd be preparing this, and June is Women in Tabletop Gaming Month. So I want to make sure that we talk. We started a very interesting conversation, I felt like, on email here about women in tabletop gaming and how to encourage more representation. I guess first, what is your perspective as someone who has been in the realm of RPGs? How has it been for you? Have you found barriers? Do you find that there's gatekeepers that might discourage you? What's your experience?
Basically, I'm a lucky dinosaur. I've been gaming since the late 70s, early 80s, and I was lucky enough to get involved with gamers who are amazing people. The thing is, because of when I started gaming, there are certain things I will not notice. Lee Gold at one point told us a story about how she was publishing a game. The publisher said to her, "You want to put your husband's name on the cover with yours?" And she's like, "Why? He didn't write it." "Well, a lot of women want to put their husband's name." "Yeah, I'm not one of them." "But a lot of women, do you want to publish my game or not?" And she only realized afterwards that he was trying to pressure her to do this. It just struck her as, why would anyone, why would I? I mean, you know, he did some of the proofreading, but I wrote the game here. When I was reading Masks of Nyarlathotep in, oh God, that would be the mid-80s. So Masks, bluntly, is potentially a very rapey campaign.
Yeah.
At least when it comes to the NPCs. With the PCs, that kind of depends on what your group is willing to do and not do, and what your GM is willing to do and not do, and how good all of you are at not being jerks. But I'm reading this with the, yeah, so you've got the death rituals and you've got the sex rituals. I'm going, and it's all washing over me because, okay, that's what's in there. Oscar said to me, you do realize these days that sort of thing can't get published. I'm like, huh. I don't know if he's right or not, but if he's right, it's not necessarily a bad thing, partly because, yeah, it is an issue, and partly because it's also lazy writing.
Yeah.
There was a dreadful, dreadful attempt at doing a Swamp Thing series years ago where the bad guy was clearly the bad guy because he hit a woman. Okay, whether you make it hit, rape, or kill, that is a lazy way to signal someone's a bad guy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You don't have to do that. You can do that in more interesting ways. When people start pointing out, you know, we need to work on this, this, and this, I'm likely to wind up going, wait, we have to do what? And then having to just, you know, sit down and let this reach my brain because, oh, yeah, you're right. This is a problem. And this is one of the reasons I was throwing other people's names at you, because I am learning this as I go. And I'm sure a lot of people who've been gaming for as long have been learning faster. But a lot of people who haven't been gaming for as long have been learning faster still, and that's good.
There's an emergent conversation right now, it seems. And it's kind of trickling throughout the role-playing community. I think a lot of this conversation has begun in the indie space, which is just started out in such an experimental way that perhaps it reached conclusions about representation much earlier.
No one's reached conclusions about representation. It's an ongoing...
That's fair.
And it has to be an ongoing thing because...
Sure.
Society changes, society evolves. Unfortunately, sometimes society seems to move backwards. And it's passionate. It's in gaming. It's in science fiction conventions. It is the sort of thing... When I go to Worldcon with Josh, we are going to go to the Worldcon business meeting. And we are going to argue passionately over things because of representation, because of how the community is changing, because we are defining our communities. And that's a lot of what's going on here. If you think about your gaming group, how many people that you game with regularly are pretty much from the same background you're from? And for a lot of us, that would be pretty much most of them, if not all of them, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That does happen for sure.
Yeah. And one of the things that happens when more people enter the conversation is everything gets more awesome.
Totally.
You get stuff you've never seen, stuff you'd never even thought could be done. Wait, you can do that? I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah.
Can I try that?
Oh, totally agree. And, you know, maybe it's only because I'm so saturated in the horror genre of role-playing so much. I don't venture out all that much into other genres, fantasy and whatnot. But I just think in horror in particular, there's something about horror that allows us to investigate cultural fears, you know, phobias, blockages, blind spots. And right?
Have you ever been to Metatopia?
I have not been to Metatopia.
Julia Ellingbo held a panel. She put together a panel called Lovecraft WTF.
Mm.
And her bit is, you know, she was saying, yes, we can be fans of problematic things. She gets that. She is a fan of problematic things, all well and good. But can someone please explain the appeal of Lovecraft?
Okay.
Which is a totally fair question. Sure. And one of the things about Lovecraft that I find particularly horrific is one of the things he does very well is say, okay, so here's the thing. You've got your pure New England white blood, and guess what? It's tainted by them.
Yes.
And
common theme.
The horrific part of it is not that he's doing this, but that there is a part of my brain, probably most people's brains, that will react to this and go, oh my God, that's horrible. The racist part that you don't want to be there. And what those stories do is say, you thought you weren't racist? Think again, kid.
Yeah.
Think again. And it's not what he's trying to do, I am aware. But that is what I am getting from that. That is what I get from Rats in the Wall, which I could never stand up and teach when I was teaching, because there is one part of it that is very much an important part of it, because it reveals a lot about the narrator. Even if you ignore the author, which maybe you should, maybe you shouldn't, and I could not stand up in a New York City college and teach that story.
Yeah, there's plenty of Reanimator. I mean, people focus on Red Hook, horror Red Hook, as, you know, one of the worst, and it certainly has, it is.
So you want to know what privilege is? Me not realizing it's one of the worst until Ken Hite was explaining this and me rereading it going, oh my God, he's right. Because when I first read it, I read it because of the scenario that had come out that was a sort of sequel to it. And it had the story in it. And so I was reading it for the plot, and it's a crap plot.
Right. Yeah. It's weak as hell. It's not a good story on any level, really. But
rereading it, yeah, Ken's right.
Yeah.
He is talking about, oh my God, the neighbors blast their music, and it's weird music, and they're cooking weird shit. And I'm looking at this going, he's talking about my neighbors.
Right. Right.
He is talking about the people who are my neighbors, my people.
Right. And the scary Syrians. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm a New Yorker. And, oh yeah, I had somehow missed the little bit where he's like, yeah, well, we can't exterminate them, so.
Yeah.
Like, wait, what?
Right.
Oh my God, how did I miss that? I look down at my arm, look at the color of it. That's how.
Yeah. Yeah. I missed it in my teens or early 20s. Because I thought it was all character. You know, he has so many first person narratives that I dismissed it as, well, that's the character who feels that way, you know? And, so it took me a while to catch on.
It's true, but it's not the full story.
Right, right. Yeah.
And the bitch of it is Rats in the Walls is an amazing tour de force, not just because of the devolution of language at the end, but because there's this throwaway bit at the beginning about, yeah, so this was a guy who was with my son in the war, and you just sort of nod along, and then it comes back at the end, and wham!
Mm-hmm.
Why yeah. should he live when my boy died? And that's amazing. And both of these things are true at the same time.
So when you look at the balance of gender in the writing pool and the creator pool of various RPGs, some do better than others. And so in the horror space, there is Chill, and it's kind of an edge case is the White Wolf stuff, because it's sort of a dark fantasy informed by Gothic literature, sort of. But in any case, Chill, White Wolf, it's pretty balanced. I mean, maybe not from the very beginning, but certainly of recent, over the last decade, whereas the needle is moving much slower in Call of Cthulhu. Do you have any stabs in the dark about why that has come to pass? And it is changing.
It has not been a priority for the people who can make a difference to make a difference. I'm not saying they don't want to, but it has not been their priority. Again, Metatopia has a lot of panels on a lot of different social aspects, a lot of different community aspects. And I've gone to a couple that go into what you need to do to move that needle. And you can't just say, okay, so I'm putting out a call for anybody. That's a good first step. And it's a first step some people will not do. If you're putting out a collection of scenarios and you know you can get the best from these five people you know, it's really tempting to go to those five people you know will give you a solid scenario. But even if you just put out a call and you even say in that call, we encourage women, we encourage minorities, we encourage this, we encourage that, a lot of people go, yeah, they don't really mean me. Mm. They don't really mean me. My work's not good enough. Okay, what are you willing to do from there? Are you willing to go to individual people you know and say, hey, do you have something you could write? Or even, I know you have something you could write in some cases. And if they say no, are you willing to push at this? And if they say yes, are you willing to mentor them if they need it? Because you get this vicious cycle of, I've never done anything published before. I mean, I have never published a scenario. I have never written a scenario for publication. If I were to do that, the first draft would suck rocks because I have never done this before. The thing is, I know Oscar, and Oscar would probably be willing to work with me to get it publishable. And I know enough about how things work that if I'm handing something over to be published, I'm already saying, I don't mind if we rip everything up by its roots. I'm going in knowing this.
Right.
Now, Now, that's how Golden Goblin works. If somebody sends us a scenario, we may do a lot of changes to it. But are you going to be willing to work with a new writer who is raw, who won't get it right the first time? And then when you get that scenario published and polished to where you want it to be, are you willing to go back to that author and ask for another one? Are you going to say, but it was so hard to work with that author the first time, and I had to do so much work on it? Because if you're not, then you're only willing to move the needle so far. And what you're saying is you want people who are pretty much perfect to begin with, or who are finds that no one else has found. And in some cases, yeah, there are people like that out there. And in some cases, they're publishing. Lovecraft-esque. A lot of people worked on Lovecraft-esque. It is doing something very different. And there's a lot of people working on that one.
Yeah.
There are other horror games out there that I don't know about. There's Dead Scare. Powered by the Apocalypse, you're playing housewives during the 1950s when the guys are turning into zombies. I'm probably oversimplifying because I have not played this, but it's there. If you're saying, why are there no women in the horror genre writing this stuff? Are you aware of this game? If you're not aware of this game, why not? How much of the work are you willing to do?
Mm-hmm.
And again, if you're doing a magazine and you've got one issue which has good representation, what about the next one and the next one and the next one? It's a commitment. It is a commitment that is worth making, but it is a commitment that's going to have a lot of hard work. If you're not willing to say, we will do this thing, then it's not going to happen. And if you're a small publisher, trying to get the next book out and the next Kickstarter and the next, how many risks are you going to be willing to take? Oscar's taken some of them. Joe Crail did the Haiti scenario in Tales of the Caribbean. And this is not true only, you understand, of underrepresented people. It's anyone who has never worked with somebody who's working on the editing. But yeah. If you are looking for more diversity and you are in a position where you're doing the hiring, where you're looking for writers, yes, you can do this, but you have a lot of work to do. And there's a lot of stages people will go through. There's the, but I don't know anyone, so how can I possibly do this? I guess they're just not out there. Yeah, you know better than that. Okay, but where do I go look? Yeah, and there's a lot of nervousness on the part of the people who are looking for people, because did I say something that offended them? Did I do this right? And
yeah,
you're going to make mistakes, and it's going to be scary as fuck. It's just, if we don't, it's never going to change.
Yeah. You have to be able to embrace that discomfort.
Yeah.
And be able to forge ahead, because asking the question in the first place and trying to move the needle is worthwhile, even if it's discomforting. Would you have any advice for creators who may be, you know, underrepresented groups, including women in Call of Cthulhu, that, or in horror, in the horror gaming space in general, or RPG space, but that's our purview is horror. Do you have any advice that you would say to them to encourage? What can they do to break through some of the barriers and help those who are reaching out?
A few years ago, I would have said, I'm lucky and I have no idea. Now, talk to people. Kat Tobin works at Pelgrane Press. Talk to her. Drop her an email. There are groups for women gamers online. If there are groups for every community online, try to find those. Try to talk to people there. Try to find other people to talk to.
Yeah.
A lot of it does come down to networking. A lot of it does come down to luck. And the best news is that we are starting to see more representation, even in horror. I don't even know if that's even in horror or especially in horror, because I have not been tracking these. One of the things I said once to Oscar that amuses him greatly is, horror's not my genre. And he said, your resume would suggest otherwise. I mean, I've done work proofing for Art Dream. I've done playtesting for Pelgrane. I've edited Call of Cthulhu stuff, and horror's not my genre, except that it sort of is, isn't it?
Do you approach horror sort of sideways or reluctantly, or?
So I realized years ago that I was thinking of horror the way non-science fiction fans think of science fiction. I like that thing, therefore it can't be horror. And yeah, I can't do that. The first thing I had to understand was a lot of what I liked and sort of assumed was not horror is in fact horror. And that therefore, it's not that I don't like horror. It's that there are types of horror I don't care for. With gaming, as an editor, it's different because what I'm looking for is, does the plot hold up? Does the mystery hold up? Because so much of the horror gaming I'm involved in boils down to mystery.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Investigation. Sure.
If we are talking horror, okay. Does it work? Greg Stolze is one of the only people who has ever made me squirm out of character about a moral decision I made in character. That is very hard to do because one of two things is likely to happen when you're making a moral decision in character. Either you're sufficiently detached that if it's a horrible decision, you know going in it's a horrible decision and you've decided, right, I'm playing my character, my character is doing this bad thing, let's go, which is awesome. The other thing you're likely to do if you don't do that is decide that, no, it's not a horrible decision. I made it. It must have been the right decision and find a way to justify it. So, there's a certain area of discomfort. I've talked about discomfort reading before as well, that's important. There's a certain layer where there's a certain catharsis. The LARPing world is also one where a whole lot of dialogue about representation is taking place, and there is no one LARPing community. There are many LARPing communities.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, in looking at specifically women in gaming, it keeps cropping up that people find that the LARPing space going way back has been much more diverse than the tabletop. I don't know why. I'm sure someone's looked into it in more sophisticated ways than I have.
The two-word answer I was given, I don't know if it is correct or not, is White Wolf.
That's what brought in so many women to gaming in the 90s? Or why White Wolf?
It brought in a lot of women into gaming, and it brought in a lot of women into LARPing, because one of the things that White Wolf did is, we're going to have a LARP of our games.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, how much work are you willing to do? White Wolf was willing to do a lot of work to get their LARPs up and running, to get people invested in running White Wolf LARPs.
But I mean, is there something, this is really something I'm puzzling over. What is it about LARPing that has brought that where there are more women playing, even going back to times when I would say it was much more of a monolithic player base in tabletop? Why LARPing? Is there something?
Was it?
Yeah.
No, seriously, was it? I got into gaming in the early 80s.
Well, that's fair. And there's, you know, absolutely. And well, let me ask you then, you've been.
And let me actually tell you another story I heard. This is second or third hand through the internet.
Mm.
It goes like this. Where are all the people of color in gaming? Well, we're playing with our own groups because we don't trust you guys.
Yeah.
And that's fair.
Yeah.
That is totally fair. Or maybe they're not. Maybe there are plenty of people who are playing with other gamers and we just don't know those groups because how much work are we willing to do?
Yeah. Totally fair. Was your experience gaming all the way back to your early days gaming that there were a lot of women at the table and that, or that you were having all women groups that were not, you know, that
no.
were there?
No. Okay. In high school, there were a couple of women who were GMing and at least one other woman who was playing with me in the group. Okay, technically we were all girls and boys then because it was high school. But at conventions, so, you know, I don't remember the exact gender breakdown of any particular group. I was sometimes the only woman at the table, sometimes not. It may be also the types of games I signed up for. I didn't sign up for D&D. I signed up for Call of Cthulhu. I signed up for Over the Edge. I signed up for Everway when Everway was a thing. If you're signing up for Call of Cthulhu, you're already signing up for a game where people are going in knowing you can lose. It's always on the table. You can totally fail spectacularly, and that's okay.
And that would draw, but what are you saying about the population that would be attracted?
What I'm saying is whether you're getting women or men there, you're getting people who are used to it, who are willing to accept a different style, who are going in saying, yeah, maybe I don't want to just knock down the door, get the treasure, kill the monster.
Yeah.
You're getting people who are saying, okay, yes, there are plenty of different campaigns for Dungeons and Dragons, but I want to play this horror game where I'm probably going to lose.
Yeah.
Although, actually, that's one of the myths about Call of Cthulhu. There's a lot of games where you can win a Call of Cthulhu scenario for certain values of win.
Sure. And I think especially more recently, that's the style is to at least provide a way in most scenarios. Not all, but.
At Origins, I got into playing a lot of Call of Cthulhu games. And year after year, it's the same people showing up to play Call of Cthulhu.
Mm-hmm.
And I know these people. It's not, are there men or women? It's, okay, there's Dylan. Okay, I'm blanking on your name. Cliff, right. And there's, Misty's running a game. Got to get into one of Misty's games. Her game's good.
Hmm.
And then there's all these people whose names maybe I don't remember so well, but I've gamed with them. And it's not your local group, but these are people you know after a while. The system that surprised me, Reliquary Games has this game Clockwork Dominion, which I fixated on because somewhere along the line, I developed a taste for Victorian RPGs. I don't know why, I don't know how, but the bug bit me. And it had this card-based resolution system that, reading about, I was sure I would hate, and oh my god, it's amazing.
Really? Cool.
Basically, you get a number of cards for your initiative, usually three, maybe four, maybe the best three out of four, whatever. You play them face up so everybody sees them. And you go around in high card order. And when it's your turn, you flip down your highest card. But here's the thing. If you want to interrupt someone, flip down any two of your cards and you get to interrupt. And that makes everything...
Oh, that's a cool mechanic.
It makes everything interesting. It means people are paying attention to the whole combat, whether they're involved or not. Because you can interrupt at any point. You can interrupt and interrupt.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. That's pretty cool. What is it called again?
Clockwork Dominion.
Yeah.
I'm actually running two sections of it at Gen Con.
Oh, cool. Oh, you're going to be at Gen Con. I think I'm going to be at Gen Con, too. So there.
I have the Insane Lisa schedule because I always have the Insane Lisa schedule.
Right.
Just to say... Yeah, I leave some time for sleeping and I leave time for shopping, but I'm there to play games.
Right. Well, I think that we should probably put a button on this. It's been a really rich conversation and a lot of fun, and we sort of work in parallel a little bit. It was so nice to talk to you, you know, at length. This has been fun.
Yeah, and we'll see if we can meet at Gen Con at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I know you're busy, but even just to high five on the way to games or something, it would be kind of nice just to check in.
That could work.
Thank you so much for joining us and for this rich conversation. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Want to hear from our listeners? Then we have a lot of different ways you can reach out to us.
For the complete list, check out the show notes. That's where you'll find our email address, which is mup.feedback@gmail.com, as well as the phone number, SpeakPipe link, and our forums.
Send us your questions, feedback, and topic ideas, or join a discussion, record a line, or tell us who you are, and give us a hearty go pods for our home team to fight encephalopods.
Find all the links you need to keep in touch at mu-podcast.com/148.
Thanks for joining us for another episode. Class is dismissed.
The Call of Cthulhu role-playing game is property of Chaosium, Inc. The written works of H.P. Lovecraft are held in the United States public domain. All other works mentioned in this podcast are the property of their respective owners. Original content of this show is copyright of the Miskatonic University Podcast under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license.